The Tom Woods Show, episode 1315.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Homeschooling families, it's the middle of the academic year, and that's when a lot of families decide to ditch the curriculum they're using and try something better. Well, if you want to maintain your mental health and give your kids an outstanding education, then check out the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum. And when you use my link, you get $160 worth of free bonuses as well. My link is ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. Today, I got a couple of things for you. First thing is, I'm going to play you a decent portion of an interview I did back in 2011, if you can believe that, when my book Rollback had just come out, which was about my preferred title for that book was Everything Should Be Repealed. No, Everything Should Be Abolished. That was actually my preferred title. Everything Should Be Abolished. So the publisher went with Rollback. So anyway, I did this interview and I just found it the other day. I totally forgot about this. I've done so many interviews, I just forgot. And it's just called Liberty and Production Radio. I have no idea what this is. Host Shane Coley. And we just talk about a bunch of stuff. Now, for all I know, it's all familiar to you. I don't know, but maybe there's some gems in here, but I could use an interview episode. So that's what I'm doing here. So I hope you like it. Especially if you're a beginner to the podcast, you'll be introduced to some important themes. And we can all bear to hear things more than once. But as I say, I'm sure there's plenty of good original stuff in here. But after that's over, don't switch off your device, because I found something online just as I was about to sit down and record this opening portion. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to sneak this into the episode. You know, for the people who forge their way through, I want to reward them with just an interesting news item, let's say, that I think people who listen to this show might appreciate. So here comes the interview, and I will link to, what am I going to link to? I don't know, I'll link to something. Certainly over on the show notes page, which is tomwoods.com/1315, I will link to the item that my secret news story is all about. So that's that, and I hope you enjoy this. Here we go.
I want to mention another book, Nullification, Idaho. Governor Butch Otter is working hard to overcome the resistance in his own legislature with regard to nullification. Could you talk about that just a second?
Well, sure. I don't want to take for granted people know what it is. I'm sure your listeners are unusually well-educated compared to the general public, but nullification is Thomas Jefferson's idea, which is starting to make a bit of a comeback, that when you're faced with a federal government that acts as if it has no limits, somebody has to limit it. You can't expect it to limit itself. It's just common sense. And he makes a very good historical and logical argument that the bodies that need to limit it are the states. The states need to refuse to enforce unconstitutional laws, and we're starting to see this pop up now once again. Of course, the usual suspects are condemning this, why this is so terribly extreme, and so on and on. But yes, that's true. It's not something that you'll find in that 3x3-inch box that goes from Joe Biden to Mitt Romney. I admit that. But I happen to think that given the situation we're in, it's going to take something just a teensy-weensy bit outside that box to fix it. So what's been going on in Idaho is that there was a nullification bill regarding federal health care law that was passed by the lower house of the state legislature. The state house passed it 49-20. They had unprecedented hearings there regarding nullification. Hundreds of people came. The ABC News station in Boise did a story about, I'm happy to say, the influence of my book on all this. They said the governor had read it. The state legislators had read it. I had spoken at Boise State University to a packed house there just a couple of months earlier. Now, the state Senate then voted it down. But to me, that the big story is not that, actually. The big story is that the lower house voted to go for it in spite of all of fashionable opinion in the country condemning them and ridiculing them and saying how stupid and ignorant they were, when in fact the critics are the stupid and ignorant ones in my experience, having interacted with them. They had every amount of pressure you could imagine put on them, and they still went ahead with it, and the governor was urging them to do it. That's the story. So, okay, the first time through, it didn't succeed. But for heaven's sake, given that not one right-wing radio host even mentioned this, I didn't hear Glenn Beck talking about it. I didn't hear Hannity. I didn't hear Mark Levin. I didn't hear Limbaugh. None of these people even mentioned it. And yet these people fought and fought and fought for it anyway, and all they got were smears and condemnations. That is the story. And they are not finished yet, and I suspect we're going to have one of our great – there's a great Nullify Now tour, nullifynow.com, going on around the country. I think we're going to have one of those in Boise. We're going to keep the pressure on. But that's really amazing at what can be done even in complete defiance of the media and defiance of the complete lack of interest on the part of supposedly conservative radio hosts. Stuff can still be done. That's the story.
Well, and there's so much to learn from that whole – scenario. For one thing, we cannot count on our conservative radio hosts, our typical neocon conservative voices in any quarter, to talk about the things that actually solve problems. Those things which actually solve problems are going to be swept under the rugs because there are people who feed the appetite people have to talk about the problems, but they don't want to talk about solutions. And so we need to be very careful to look for the truth because we're not going to get it just by listening to normal conservative radio talk or any other.
No, it's absolutely true. I mean, they have been completely silent on this issue. It's like they're pretending it's not happening. It's absolutely bizarre. Now, the one exception – well, there are a couple of exceptions. Mike Church is the best talk show host on satellite radio. He's on Sirius XM 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern time every day, Monday through Friday. He's great to listen to, and he is utterly fearless, unlike most of these cowards. We've got Jerry Doyle, who's got a big show, and he's been favorable. But the key guy is Walter Williams. Now, Walter Yes. Williams is a sit-in host for Rush, and of course, Rush would die a thousand deaths before talking about nullification, but the fearless Williams just the other day, who, by the way, has a nice blurb on the back cover of my book, Nullification, just went on and on about how necessary it is. We have to think this way. Well, great, great. Good for him, and he deserves to be cheered for that. And incidentally, people interested in this, let me direct you to a free resource that I put up, statenullification.com. You can get a lot of information about it, replies to objections, free videos to watch. All this stuff is up there so the general public will know about it and be able to defend the idea vigorously in public. Statenullification.com.
Excellent resource. Okay, well, we want to talk about rollback today, which is subtitled Repealing Big Government Before the Coming Fiscal Collapse. And I want to make a few statements that are common language to the Liberty and Production audience as a backdrop to our conversation. So it would go like this. Here on Liberty and Production, we try to remember two things because we like to focus on principle and not be sidetracked by trivia. First, with regard to liberty, we recognize the difference between the state and lawful government. The state is not government. It is an imposter, a pretender, a fake. The state is a monopoly of force organized for legal plunder. On the other hand, lawful government is valuable to society. The proper role of lawful government is to defend life, liberty, and property of the individual. Second, with regard to production, we notice that people depend on production. People eat food and use things. Food and things must be produced. The state, being an imposter, is a thief which produces nothing and wastes much. Since people depend on production and the state interferes with production, there is no way that the state has any solutions for us. We must remember that every promise made by a government official has to be kept by a producer. There is no other way. So with that being the view that we hold here on Liberty and Production, you can understand why I value Nullification and Rollback and the other works of yours so highly.
Well, thank you. I mean, that more or less is my theme here, that unfortunately we're living in at a time when people seem to think there's some kind of big pile of cash somewhere on Big Rock Candy Mountain that we can just keep drawing from. Just the other day I saw a poll in which a majority of Americans were saying that probably taxes would have to be raised to get us out of the current budget crisis. And, of course, what they mean by that is somebody else's taxes will have to be raised.
Yes.
There's always some sucker who needs to be looted instead of them. And then secondly, the other thing was they thought that Medicare and Social Security payments needed to be increased. increased. I mean, the programs are in the hole $114 trillion already. That's not enough for these people. So again, it's like that there's this effortless way that resources can just be continually allocated to you and your friends, and that we cannot afford to live in this fantasy land any longer. What I'm basically saying in Rollback is that we are now hitting the brick wall that people have warned about for years. We're hitting a brick wall with the budget and with the entitlement programs where we're going to have a complete fiscal meltdown. It is mathematically unavoidable. This is not the sky is falling. I can actually take pictures of the sky falling. Mm-hmm, I can show this is going to happen.
Yes.
And so the 90% of the book, because I would rather jump off a building than write or read a book about the federal budget. Most of the book is about, well, given this, we can't afford to believe in Big Rock Candy Mountain anymore. We can't afford to believe in the sixth grade version of government that we were taught, you know, that government is full of wise public servants pursuing the public good. And if it weren't for them, we'd have no art or science. We'd have no culture. We'd all be ignorant. We'd be dying from exploding computer monitors. We'd all be working in a mine for a dollar a day. I understand why people believe this. It seems plausible. But it's this type of myth that government just has my well-being at heart, and for heaven's sake, who could object to giving them ever more resources? That mentality has been very, very expensive. That mentality has put us in this position, and it's that mentality. It's not just the government we have to, and its budget that we have to take a machete to. It's this childish mentality that needs to be cut down to size. And I am mercilessly going after all these arguments by which big government has been sold to us to begin with in this book.
And you do an incredibly potent job of laying down the foundation with facts to support the claims that you make. There's nothing in the book that you don't support vigorously and clearly. I'm curious, this myth of good government that you write about and these ideas that you've just explained that we believe that are actually leading us toward destruction, how do those ideas get propagated into the marketplace? How do they get propagated into the mind of the American citizen?
Well, I like to give this analogy. I like to encourage people to think this way. I say, let's suppose instead of being educated by the government, which most people are through government schools, let's imagine that you were instead educated by Walmart. And so your kids went to Walmart schools, and every day they went into a classroom in which adorning the walls were all the Walmart CEOs over the years. And then once a year, every year, we had a special annual ceremony in which we honored all the Walmart CEOs and their indispensable contributions to our well-being and how lost we'd all be without them and so on. If we did that, I think a lot of people would think this was kind of propaganda, a little bit spooky. People would be skeptical of these claims. However, when it's U.S. presidents all over the walls, well, for some reason, our critical faculties go right out the window. Why, these are our wonderful, glorious protectors. Wherever would we be without them? That is what I got. I mean, I can't be the only one who was taught this way. That's what I got when I was in school. My goodness, for heaven's sake, wherever would we be if it weren't for Franklin Roosevelt? Why, people would be dying in the streets. The earth would break free of its axis and go spinning toward the sun. It's a version of things that you get from the start, from the very institution we're talking about here is the one that also educates you. So it's quite a racket they have going. And then, of course, the media is overwhelmingly populated by people who favor the present system. So they, of course, for the most part, want to flatter our wise overlords, as I call them. If they have Ben Bernanke on their programs, they don't grill him. They throw softballs at him. If Barack Obama is on, they throw softballs at him. He's our wise overlord. We're barely even worthy to stand in his presence. I mean, well, naturally, over time, what's going to be reinforced in the mind of the public? Precisely these ideas. And so this is why we have to go around the traditional avenues of communication. We have to go around the ABC Newses and the World News Tonight and the CNNs. And we need to take to the internet and take to alternative sources so that people can find out what's really going on, so that you can break out of the George Orwell novel that you're living in and find out the truth.
Very well said. And just like we were talking about the conservative talk show hosts with regard to nullification, nullification is that principle whereby we say the federal government has certain authority, and when they go outside of that, what they say is meaningless. It's null and void. That's nullification. Tremendous tool in the hands of the citizens of the states, and it is not talked about. If it does get mentioned. It gets mentioned in a derogatory way. Likewise, we have presidents like Abraham Lincoln that are revered when in fact he imprisoned thousands of U.S. citizens, including members of the legislature. He shut down newspapers. He emancipated or freed the people who were enslaved in the states that he had no authority over and left them enslaved in the states that he did have authority over. And we revere him. And then you have someone like Grover Cleveland, who vetoed more legislation than the 21 presidents who came before him, standing firmly for liberty, and made the statement that while the people perhaps should support the government, it is not the government's place to support the people. We don't even hear about him. So we have plenty of examples to see that what we are told is not what we need to hear. What we are told is not the true history of our nation, nor is it the proper narrative for lawful government.
And of course, every once in a while when we have to endure these terrible polls of historians in which they rank the presidents, of course, you know, it's the worst presidents who wind up on top and vice versa. And of course, there's no objective way to rank the presidents. Any way you rank them is simply a reflection of your own views and values. So these historians are trying to portray themselves as these impartial scientific scholars who are going to tell us who the best ones are. How dare they? As if there's some independent way of judging this. You judge them according to your values, and mine are for freedom. And those are not the values by which they're judged by these historians. And so indeed, you get precisely this distorted view, and you get the impression that the best kind of president is the one who's, constantly subverting the Constitution, constantly overturning the established order, whereas a president who feels like it's his job to humbly execute the laws is some kind of, you know, pathetic boob we should disparage. And incidentally, when we say that it's not up to the government to give things to the people, it's not because we're stingy or we hate mankind or whatever the left would say about it. But when we look at the actual record of government versus the market, when it comes to, for example, alleviating poverty, there isn't even a comparison. I mean, if you look at the record from 1820, we look at the whole world, 85% of the world was living in what economists call absolute poverty. By 1950, that was down to 50%. By 1980, it was at 33%. By 2001, it was down to 18%, continually falling as the market economy spreads around the world. In the United States, where the criteria for poverty, of course, are much higher, in 1900, we would say that literally 95% of the public was living in what we would today consider poverty. By the late 1960s, that was down to about 14%. And it was only in the late 1960s that the LBJ programs, the War on Poverty programs, actually began to get serious funding. So that means that that incredible conquest of poverty occurred almost without any government involvement at all, or extremely minimal government involvement. But as soon as the government gets really involved, spends trillions of dollars, by the early 1990s, it has quadrupled the amount of money it was spending in the late 60s per person on poverty. It totally stagnates. Now, I mean, that is something you would think we'd learn about in school. You'd think we'd hear that on television. But the impression we get in those places is that the opposite must be true, that we were making no progress against poverty until the government got involved, and then we've made progress. Exactly the opposite is the truth, and this is based on statistics that anyone can easily verify. How they get away with scamming the public like this is completely beyond me.
Well, it's an amazing accomplishment, I can say that, and it comes from being able to control the education of the students, which of course was one of the objectives of what we would call the progressives from many years ago. So it's a serious problem. We have to learn to think again. One of the things in Rollback that you mentioned are the Harvard professors, and it reminded me of a banking conference that I attended in Texas in 2008, where the president of the Federal Home Loan Bank of Dallas was the keynote speaker. And he had a lot of really clever charts and was a very good speaker, very articulate. And he laid out a case that would make sense unless you actually understand the financial system, the banking system. And one of the comments that he made was that the economy would recover as soon as consumer confidence returned. So when people become confident, the economy will recover. You and I know that people's needs are met by production, not by confidence. But I ask him the question, confidence in what? Well, he talked around in circles for a minute, and when he finished, I said, okay, I understand what you said, but my question is, the economy will recover when consumer confidence in what returns? He acknowledged that he didn't answer the question and moved ahead. So would you say then that these people and institutions depend on our ignorance and these false narratives in order to maintain their power?
No question about it. No question about it, which is why some people have gone so far as to say it can't possibly be an accident that the kids just keep getting dumber and dumber and dumber. I mean, if you were running a racket like this, you know, based on looting the public and telling them it's for their own good, you'd want them to be as stupid and docile and have as pointless lives as possible. It's precisely what you would want. I'm not so sure I'm willing to go that far, but it's hard to argue against it. And particularly this guy, he's, as you say, he's got a causal connection entirely reversed. It's not that consumer confidence leads to a prosperous economy. The prosperous economy is what leads to the confidence.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, you have to have that first. It's not just that, gosh, people have just arbitrarily stopped spending, and if all we could do is get them spending again. It's this juvenile focus entirely on spending. The economy is not just about spending money. It's about taking resources and deploying them in patterns that correspond with consumer desires. And unfortunately, because of all the stimulus and the messing with interest rates, those patterns have been hopelessly distorted right now. And right now, the market is trying, with no help from the government, which keeps interfering with it, to sort things out again and get the patterns correct and making sure that we're investing enough in this and not too much in that, and we get more resources out of housing and into something else. That's what the market is trying to do. Meanwhile, the government's giving tax credits for people to keep buying houses, keep building houses. It's exactly the wrong thing to do. This has nothing to do with whether consumers are confident or not. It's whether the market is allowed to readjust. But yeah, all this stuff entirely depends on ignorance. And I'm telling you, I mean, I've been able, thanks to YouTube and all these wonderful innovations of the past number of years, I've been able to reach so many people who have said to me, my gosh, if I had only had 15 minutes of listening to what it is you're saying, I could have saved myself the grief of years and years of indoctrination. So we have the chance now. And you might say, but on the other hand, don't the indoctrinators themselves also have YouTube they can use? True. But before YouTube, they had a monopoly. Right. On the opinion molders, on opinion molding. But now we've got a leg, you know, a foot in the door that we didn't have before, and that's what matters.
Well, you know, one of the things that I talk about when I try to explain to people that we do have hope is if you're propagating a lie, you have to totally control the entire environment. You must have that monopoly because you have to discredit every idea that is in conflict with what you're presenting, and it takes a lifetime. Whereas when you're presenting truth, just like you said about the 15 minutes, when you're presenting truth, only a little time and you can enlighten a person, you can open their eyes because what you're saying matches what they can see in reality. So truth doesn't take that protection and it doesn't take that long period of time. And that's one of the reasons that we have hope, particularly when we can break the monopoly by communicating directly with people.
I've been so encouraged, for example, at how I've been able to spread things like when I wrote the book on nullification, for example, I knew that anybody who writes a book like that, people are going to say, oh, I bet you probably support slavery. It's so stupid, like somebody in the year 2011 supports slavery, but
right.
That you probably support slavery. You're probably an evil person who wants to oppress people. So I preemptively smashed that whole line of argument by making a simple 8-minute video called Interview with a Zombie.
It's beautiful.
And let me recommend people go, even if you've already seen the video, I've also put up the blooper tape, which is actually much funnier than the original video, at interviewwithazombie.com. I'm urging you to watch this because this way I had a guy dressed up as a zombie and he's throwing at me the kinds of arguments I would get in the mainstream media, you know, racism and whatever, all these arguments. And the point of the video is that I keep answering all this with information, with cogent arguments, and all he can do is just keep calling me names and giving me one-word responses. And the idea, of course, is that this is how an interview with Keith Olbermann would go, but Keith Olbermann wouldn't have the excuse of being a zombie.
Right.
So, but it was a great way. So now every time I get attacked, all my friends just go to wherever is attacking me, and in the comments section, they just post a link to Interview with a Zombie, and they say, hey, this guy's a zombie. And the poor guy who wrote the original post attacking me doesn't know what hit him.
It's beautiful. It was a very shrewd move, and I'm sure it served very well. I would like, if you would, Tom, just to give us a summary set of comments about Rollback. And one of the things that we're going to do, you're going to be sending me a copy of Rollback that I'm going to give away to a listener here at Liberty in Production. But if you would, just tell us a little bit more about it. Give us a summary review of the book.
Sure. There's a lot of information on it at tomwoods.com. In fact, I've even done a YouTube on it. I'm just appealing directly to the public. But basically, what I'm doing is chapter one, which I know I've given out a lot of websites so far. I have statenullification.com, tomwoods.com, interviewwithazombie.com. But you can get a free chapter of my book at rollbackbook.com. And it's just chapter one. It's just laying out, this is the situation we're in. These are facts that nobody disputes. So I'm not just contriving some non-existent crisis. It's a real thing we're enduring. But then it just goes on. It's like I'm peeling the layers of an onion. It's like I'm imagining a regular Tea Party guy picking this up and thinking, okay, this will give me some ammunition against Obama. But this book is going to give him a lot more than he bargained for, because the next chapter is, okay, yeah, Obama's a problem. Here are the problems with the healthcare thing. This would be a better way of dealing with it. Here's the problem with stimulus spending, why it doesn't work. Okay, so far so good. Next chapter, the financial crisis. Was this really just a matter of deregulation causing it? What was deregulation? Would any of these regulations have prevented the crisis? All these arguments that we're told, I go through and show how the government is in fact the institution that aggravates and promotes rather than cures these crises. That's another layer. The next layer is the Federal Reserve System. A lot of people feel like, I don't know what this thing is. I'm never going to understand it. It's too complicated. That's just what they want you to think. And I go through and explain what it is, and answer all the usual arguments. Well, gee, hasn't it given us more stability? Hasn't the economy been healthier since we had it? I go through all that. Then I go into the Pentagon, because this is supposed to be the one thing that's off limits. I mean, if you want to talk about military spending, what are you, some kind of commie? That used to be my view. What are you, some kind of commie? We need all this. And I'm showing that, in fact, the Pentagon is the one department that's not subject to an audit, and you'll see why. I'm showing the way the money's been spent, the procurement methods, the manipulation, the way that military spending has become a giant jobs program. So even when these systems are totally out of date, we don't need them, they serve no purpose, they go on and on and on and on. So, yeah, they would love us to think that we can't touch it and, you know, we would be instantly taken over by Muslims if $3 were cut. That's just the way they want us to think. We can't afford to think that way anymore. And finally, I have a chapter, The Myth of Good Government. Here I go after all the hardest things. Well, gee, wouldn't we have no science if it weren't for government science funding? Isn't Sweden an example of how you can have very high welfare spending and still be prosperous? Or, what would we do without the regulatory apparatus? Or, I mean, all these sorts of things. And then finally, the last chapter is, what, if anything, can we do? And that is going to be a lot of stuff in there that you won't read in a Newt Gingrich book. This is very much thinking outside the box stuff, so that when you close that book, I want you to feel like, if you feel like I didn't just blow your mind with this book, then I'll feel like I gypped you. You should get your money back.
Excellent. And I agree with your comments. It's a tremendous book, as I said from the beginning, with a great foundation of solid facts and cogent arguments that really blow the myth of good government right out of the water, because today we're subject to tyranny as far as I'm concerned. And there are many more things that we could raise as examples of that, but there's only a little time in the day. So I would ask one other question. I've noticed that Ron Paul won the CPAC straw poll for president 2 years running, and Town Hall just released a presidential straw poll that is conducted on the internet. I think it's a running poll, and he was about 2.75 points behind the leader, who was Sarah Palin, in that poll. Why is Ron Paul's popularity increasing? Is it just his charisma, or is it his ideas?
I think a lot of people are coming to acknowledge that he's been right about an awful lot of things. I mean, you know, John McCain was saying the fundamentals of the economy are sound in 2007. I mean, how clueless can you possibly be? And he admitted that he didn't know that much about economics, but he had Alan Greenspan's book. Heaven help us. I mean, this is your nominee. You know, and then meanwhile, the guy who's being pitched to the Tea Party, you're supposed to read his books, is Dick Morris, You know, the con man who says his favorite U.S. senator is John McCain. I mean, it's like the lunatics are running the asylum. Mm-hmm. But yet Ron Paul has stuck to his guns. He doesn't matter the way they smear him or laugh at him. He just sticks to it. And there's been a lot of education that's gone on in the past few years. People have learned that, you know what? You're not a kookish crank to talk about the Federal Reserve. You're a crank not to talk about it, for heaven's sake. After what it's done and what its record has been and its role in the current financial crisis, you have to talk about it. And the foreign policy has continued to blow up in our faces. It's an enormous expenditure of money and lives. And we've even got Tony Blankley, who was formerly on Newt Gingrich's staff, saying we got to get out of Afghanistan. This is ridiculous. George Will saying that. So it's not just Ron Paul anymore. A lot of people are saying a lot of these sorts of things. So it's almost cool to support Ron Paul now. And a lot of these younger people too. I mean, they weren't even old enough to be politically aware then, but they watch YouTube. They've been following along closely. And people have said, by the way, I was at CPAC. I spoke there. I had a wonderful event. I had the privilege of, in a giant ballroom, interviewing Ron and Rand Paul for all to see in front of a large, enthusiastic audience. It's a wonderful experience for me. I will cherish that forever. But they say, oh, it's not fair. The straw poll, the results are just not fair because Ron Paul inspired all these people to come vote for him. well, okay, but I mean, like, isn't that the point?
Exactly.
Why is it that these other people inspire nobody? How come Newt Gingrich gets 5% in that poll? Nothing's stopping people in D.C. from taking 10 minutes, going over to CPAC and voting for the guy. And yet Ron Paul gets 30% of the vote. And then Gary Johnson, who's very similar to Ron Paul, gets 6%, comes in third. That wasn't reported about at all. How do you account for the fact, and they never answer this question, okay, maybe Ron Paul has a big following of people who will do a lot for him. Why do the other candidates not have that kind of following?
Right.
That's never answered.
Would you say that 30 years of voting in line with the Constitution would represent credibility and leadership?
I indeed do think so. You can't, you know, people can give phony baloney pretty speeches every few years to get reelected. And some people are suckers enough to believe in the speeches. And, I mean, there are people who actually think Newt Gingrich is a right winger. If you look at his record, it's absolutely horrendous.
Exactly.
But he knows how to touch the hot buttons of his base. I mean, you have to give him credit for being a shrewd politician. He is very skilled at that. But whereas Ron Paul has got something that you can't duplicate, you can't make up. There's no way to be a phony and have this type of record. I mean, the record is, you know, he is what he says he is, and he's been willing. He has stood alone voting no more often than all other U.S. congressmen combined.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he's been willing to take all the smears and the ridicule for that. Well, I mean, you would think even his worst opponent needs to at least honor the integrity of that.
Right. Now, if Ron Paul really knew what he was talking about and really was committed to these ideas, he would write a book, wouldn't he?
Well, indeed he has.
He's written more than one. How many has he written?
Yeah, no, he's written a whole bunch. And unlike most politicians, there's actually some substance in them. I mean, I can't even imagine having to sit through Joe Biden's book or Mitt Romney's book. I mean, it would be painful. But you know, Ron Paul has written, you know, when I said, yes, of course he's written books, what I meant is not just that he's produced some paper with writing on it between two covers. Like, I mean, I know a lot of politicians have done that, but he's actually, his stuff actually amounts to a book because it mm-hmm. actually has thoughts in it and
yes.
it has arguments in it and evidence and, you know, and they're persuasive. And I think that's also been a help that during the presidential campaign, a lot of people weren't willing to listen to him defend his arguments. They thought, look, I've heard all I need to hear from this guy. You know, he's a crazy wacko because that's what I'm told by official opinion and I can't diverge from that. So, but you know, then they read his book, The Revolution. And because one of their friends forced them to, mm-hmm. and taking 2 hours to sit down with that thing, they say, well, you know what? Actually, come to think of it, this doesn't seem unreasonable to me at all. Like, why was I told this guy was toxic and I needed to stay away from him? When I listen to him in his own words, he makes a whole lot of sense.
And he does make a lot of sense. And he's a very wise individual and very astute and very committed to liberty, to freedom, to doing what is right, to fiscal responsibility, monetary responsibility, to lawful government. He would be a friend to anyone who loves liberty and does not want to enrich themselves at the expense of their fellows. And not only has he written The Revolution and In the Fed, but he's written books that go back many years.
Oh, yeah.
At least nine books that I can think of.
I remember getting his book, Freedom Under Siege, signed for me in the early 1990s when I first got to know him, during the period when he was out of Congress. But yeah, I know he had a book on abortion in the early 80s, and he's had a book on gold, and he's just kept on going and going. He's got a new book coming out next month. So I don't know how he does this, given his schedule, and he's always flying around the country and speaking and, you know, at events where he gets no remuneration. He's doing this because he believes in what he's doing and he wants to spread the word. I mean, again, how can you not at some level, regardless of how you feel about him, how can you not honor that?
Exactly. And actually, that's just what I was thinking, is that Ron Paul has earned our respect and our attention because he has been fighting for us while we rejected him.
Well, that's true. Well, of course, we use we differently, but
I understand. I'm referring.
Yeah, not inclusively, of course, right?
Exactly.
No, that's true. Yeah, at a time when really the general public, you're right. I mean, it was like he wasn't even. In fact, one of the things he said in our interview, was that he sort of figured he would go through Congress and no one would even notice he had ever even served in Congress. And the crowd just went nuts saying, oh my gosh, how could you possibly think that? But so that it's been quite encouraging for him now. Instead of speaking to a hall, you know, filled with 40, you know, retirees, he speaks to college crowds of 2,000.
Yes. Well, Tom, I know you have a lot to do today. I know you're preparing for the history course that begins Monday, I believe.
That's right.
I certainly appreciate your time. I very much have enjoyed the conversation, and you're welcome here with us at Liberty in Production anytime.
Thank you very much. The pleasure was mine. I appreciate it.
All right. I hope you enjoyed that. Don't turn your podcast player off, though. I have a news item I want to read to you just because I think it might be interesting. It just came to my attention, even though I guess it was released yesterday, which would have been January 7th, 2019. But before I get to that news item, let me remind you that probably one of the best ways to make sure you stay faithful to your New Year's resolution about improving yourself and your financial condition is Skillshare, because here is a platform, just like Netflix, where one membership gets you access to absolutely everything they have. Well, in this case, that's over 25,000 classes in almost anything you can think of, any technological platform you can think of, any software, not to mention things like graphic design, film production, animation, music production, audio, photography, accounting, finance, marketing, productivity, mobile development, product development, web development, crafts and culinary, almost anything you can think of. And you can find a course that will get you a leg up at your job, or will help you develop a side hustle, or even your own online business. The Skillshare folks have a special deal for my listeners. Get 2 months of access to Skillshare for free. That's right. Get 2 months worth of access to over 25,000 classes for free when you sign up at Skillshare.com/woodsfree, all one word. Skillshare.com/woodsfree gets you 2 months of free access to Skillshare. Start 2019 off with a bang by checking out Skillshare.com/woodsfree. All right, a couple more things about what's coming up, and then this item that I found intriguing. I just want you to know what's coming up. I will have guests again. If you wonder what the heck happened to the guests in 2019, is this some kind of weird New Year's resolution? I am going to have guests. It just turned out this way. I'm going to be talking to Pat Flynn, on whose show I have appeared. Not the Pat Flynn at Smart Passive Income, the other Pat Flynn. The Pat Flynn whom you're going to love. He has a brand new book called How to Be Better at Almost Everything. And it is such a relief to read a book like this and not have it just be fluff and a bunch of maxims, like you're reading a book full of fortune cookies, you know, fortune cookie fortunes. I just can't stand books like this. They are a complete waste of my time. But not this one. That's why I want to have Pat Flynn on. He has finally done it. He's written a book about personal development that actually gives you real actionable advice that works. Hey, how about that? So we'll have Pat. Plus, Pat's a great libertarian, great Rothbardian libertarian and fitness guy and just all around success. So I'll be delighted to talk to him. Then Alan Mendenhall returns. talking about libertarian literary criticism. Then later in the week, Sasha Hodder, who is a cryptocurrency lawyer who just knows the crypto world inside and out. And we're going to be talking quite a bit about that. She joined us on the Contra Cruise last year and, as did everyone, had a tremendous time. So this will be my first time having an opportunity to interview her. And remember, of course, you got to join us for that Contra Cruise coming up July 5th through the 12th, 2019, at ContraCruise.com. All right, so here's what I found over on Reddit. You remember the story of James Damore from Google? I had him as a guest on the show however many episodes ago. He was the author of that Google diversity memo, and he was saying that it was a stifling intellectual climate at Google. The environment was not one that encouraged independent thought. Rather, it was groupthink, and everybody was expected to give allegiance to a particular form of groupthink. And he was arguing that the mere fact that particular groups, now he had in mind women, but of course the logic would apply across the board, are not represented in some particular field in exact proportion to their representation in the population, is not itself evidence of discrimination or anything sinister going on. And moreover, he argued that there is good reason to believe that deliberate social engineering campaigns to bring about equal representation would have negative consequences basically for everybody. And then he went on and defended these claims. Now, that's controversial. I mean, in our day and age, that's controversial. But as you all know, he was fired. And then you have half the libertarian world cluelessly saying, well, you know, it's a private company. They can do what they want. Oh my gosh, what is the matter with you people? I know it's a private company. And I know you can come back with, but they're in bed with the government, so they're not really a private company. That's a separate kind of argument. These folks are saying, you know, oh gosh, it's a private company. Why don't you, you know, and plus even liberals, left liberals were going around saying, hey, it's a private company. They can do what they want. I bet they didn't feel that way about lunch counters in Woolworths in the 60s. Hey, it's a private company. You know, they can let anybody sit at their lunch counter. You know, so then where's the consistency here? So, of course, if they want to fire somebody, go ahead and fire them. But why, just because I'm a libertarian, can I not still be interested? I just don't get why there's this stifling refusal to talk about the actual content of things instead of just saying, well, they can do what they want. Okay, but all right, so supposing I concede that, aren't I still allowed just to look at the actual content of what they did apart from just saying they're allowed to do it? Yes, I get it. But it is interesting from a cultural standpoint to see which way the wind is blowing and which ideas are toxic enough to get you fired. So over on Reddit, we read this. Now, I don't know that this particular person works at Google, and this could be made up, but Damore himself seems to believe this is authentic and that based on the knowledge of the inner workings of Google coming out in this memo by this anonymous person, there is reason to believe the person truly does work at Google and is who that person says that person is. So it reads as follows. The headline is, I helped Google screw over James Damore. And it reads this way. I was involved in the internal decisions involving James Damore's memo, and it's terrible what we did to him. First of all, we knew about the memo a month before it went viral. HR sent it up the reporting chain when he gave it as internal feedback, but we did nothing. There wasn't anything we could do except admit to wrongdoing and lying to our employees. We just hoped that no one else would see his document. Unfortunately, the memo started spreading within the company. The floodgates opened, and previously silent employees started talking. To quell dissent, we told executives to write to their employees condemning the memo, manipulated our internal meme gen to bias the ratings toward anti-Damore posts. The head of Meme Gen is an ally to the diversity cause, and gave every manager talking points on what to tell their reports about the memo. I'm not actually sure what that means. What to tell their reports? Maybe what to tell their people? What to put in their reports? I'm not sure. In all our communications, we concentrated on how hurt employees purportedly were and diverted attention from Google's discriminatory employment practices and political hegemony, never mind the science. We needed to make an example of Damore. Looking for some excuse to fire him, we spied on his phone and computer. We didn't find anything, although our spying probably made his devices unusably slow, preventing him from organizing support within the company. When we did fire him, our reputation and integrity took a hit, but at least other employees were now afraid to speak up. Firing him without an NDA was a huge risk, though. I guess that's a non-disclosure agreement. He was a top performer and knew too many compromising secrets, like Dragonfly, the secret censored search project in China. He also had reported several legally dubious practices in search that still exist. Only God knows why he never leaked Dragonfly or the other issues, but I think it's because he actually cared about Google. How naive. Our response after we fired him was equally disgraceful. We were supposed to have a town hall TGIF to answer employees' questions about the controversy. However, after questions started coming in that we couldn't reasonably answer, we had to cancel it. We shifted the blame onto alt-right trolls and have avoided talking about it openly since then. To control the narrative, we planted stories with journalists and flexed Google's muscles where necessary. In exchange for insider access and preferential treatment, all we ask for is their loyalty. For online media, Google's ads pay their paycheck and our search brings their customers, so our influence shouldn't be underestimated. We dealt with his NLRB case in a similar way, National Labor Relations Board. People are ultimately lazy, so we found a sympathetic lawyer in the NLRB and wrote the internal NLRB memo for her. No one wanted to spend the effort to oppose it, despite it being laughably weak. Then, after Damore dropped his NLRB case and filed a class action lawsuit, we had the NLRB publicly release their memo. Our PR firm sent press releases saying the NLRB ruled the firing legal, which was, of course, manufactured BS. All of our scheming was over the phone, in deleted emails, or through an external PR firm, so we can deny all of it. Now that we've forced him into arbitration, we're close to screwing him over completely. Well, if that has any interest for you, I will link to it at tomwoods.com/1350 in the show notes page for today. And do with it as you will. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.